month ago, an anniversary came and went, which I did not take proper note of as we were dealing with various other matters at the time. But it's relevant to what I want to offer this morning, so I'm going to loop back a few weeks to pick it up. Unfortunately, it's one of the more tragic anniversaries in our nation's history. This past April 4th marked the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee. As I've mentioned on other occasions, I was a seminarian in Rochester, New York at the time. Some of my fellow students who were African Americans had personal ties to Dr. King, which compounded the impact of that horrible incident upon our entire seminary community. My memories of those few days are so vivid, remain so immediate in my mind, it's hard to believe 43 years have gone by since it happened. The reason Dr. King was in Memphis on that day of April the 4th, 1968 is telling, and doesn't really get a whole lot of play, as Dr. King's story is told when his birthday is celebrated each year. He was not in Memphis to lead a civil rights rally in the traditionally understood terms of what a civil rights rally was. By that I mean he was not there to advocate for the racial desegregation of public facilities or restaurants or swimming pools and the like. Neither was he there to advocate for voting rights for African Americans. As a matter of law, these things have largely, not entirely, but largely been enacted by 1968, even though their full enactment still seriously lagged. Now, Dr. King was in Memphis at the invitation of a local Methodist minister who was involved in a local organization there called the Community on the Move for Equality. This group had been formed to support striking sanitation workers, garbage collectors, as the more colloquial terminology would have it. The great majority of these workers were African Americans, but their race was not the forefront issue. They were striking for greater job safety after two of their workers had been killed when a compactor mechanism on one of the trucks got accidentally triggered. They were striking for better wages and benefits, and of particular interest, I find they were striking for union recognition. It was for this latter reason that their efforts were being most vigorously opposed by the local political power structure in Memphis. Dr. King, that is to say them, was killed on his way to speak at a rally of public employees who were seeking to form a union. In one sense of the term, he was speaking for the cause of civil rights, but in this case, it was about the rights of working people that both included and then transcended race. Dr. King, indeed, has been called a martyr because of civil rights and racial equality. And in a broad sense, that is certainly true. But his death came at a time when he was beginning to make connections. He was coming to see that the causes of racial equality and racial justice to which he had devoted his career at that point were part of a greater issue of social and economic justice. Well, maybe that connection had been in his mind all along, and it wasn't until after some of the more initial and immediate goals of the civil rights movement for racial equality had been accomplished that Dr. King felt it was the right time to take his efforts to the next level. His appearance in Memphis was a precursor to a poor people's campaign he was planning to take to Washington, D.C. that following summer, 5 years after the celebrated I Have a Dream speech he had given there. So while I may be a month late in reflecting on Dr. King's death, the first day of May is an appropriate one for recalling those circumstances that surrounded his death. Among the various worldwide celebrations that take place on this day, some of them having to do with the arrival of spring and dancing around maypoles and such as that, beautiful day for doing that. If you guys on your bike trip find a maypole somewhere, you can stop and dance around a little bit there. But this is also International Workers' Day, which is rooted in the struggle for the 8-hour working day for hourly wage earners, and in the Chicago Haymarket riots of 1886, when strikers at the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company were fired upon, and four of them were killed. In fact, the whole story of the labor movement, both in this country and worldwide, is a compelling and fascinating one, one that is well beyond the scope of this particular sermon. Dr. King's journey to Memphis, however, is one segment, really, of that larger and still ongoing story. My recalling the circumstances surrounding Dr. King's death over 4 decades ago and the currents swirling around our political landscape do have a way of coming together. For the larger issue that Dr. King was seeking to address on the day that he lost his life and on the day that we lost him had to do in good measure with the role of the civil government when it came to protecting, promoting, and advancing the rights and well-being of working people, which is to say a pretty good chunk of our citizens. Martin Luther King was first and foremost, as he maintained himself, a minister and a moral leader. But he knew that in order for him to stay faithful in that role, as particularly he was coming to take it on in the public arena, he had to be in conversation, sometimes even contentious conversation, with the political power structures of his day, from the local up to the national levels. And that conversation, which had been going on well before Dr. King's time, it continues to this day. As we have seen, it has become quite vigorous in recent months in many parts of our country, from Madison, Wisconsin, to our own state of New Hampshire, and with a number of stops in between and all around. I hope I don't disappoint too much if I don't get into the particulars of these legislative battles now taking place across our political landscape. Strongly as I know many of you feel about them, my announcement earlier, you'll have an opportunity to have some of that conversation during our coffee hour. I would like to speak, though, to that bigger issue, which I believe Dr. King was seeking to address. And that issue is what constitutes a proper and even necessary role of the civil government at any number of levels when it comes to maintaining and promoting the social contract. Now, while that might seem like a more appropriate topic for a civics class than for a Sunday sermon, it does have a moral dimension to it that I feel warrants the attention of persons of faith, persons of many faiths. While various political philosophers have offered their various ideas on what the social contract is and what it involves, in its broadest sense of the term, the social contract is about what makes us, it's about what makes a society a society. It's about what it is that ultimately holds a society, a nation, a state together with some sense of a common identity, and one in which each member of that society feels they have some share, some investment, and some voice in it, both individually and collectively. The overarching role and responsibility of the civil government, as I see it then, is to maintain this social contract and see that it is enacted in ways that best accomplishes and furthers the common good. And the debate behind the debate now taking place in many of our state capitals and at the federal government level is really over what constitutes that common good and what is the true nature of our social contract with one another at this point in our nation's history. Well, maybe the best way to pursue this matter is to go to our country's mission statement. Those who crafted it didn't call it a mission statement because that kind of language wasn't in use at that time when it was written. They called it instead the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. Its words, some of which I'll cite, are familiar. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare. To the credit of our founders, these words have every bit as much relevance to the state of our nation now as when they were first drafted. And I'd like you to note for just a moment what these words do not say. They do not say, we, an aggregate of individuals, each pursuing his or her own self-interest, however much the disciples of Ayn Rand may wish that were so. Short-sighted, as the authors of our Constitution may have been, and indeed were, when it came to things like enslaved Africans and the disenfranchisement of women, their intent was to shape and define a nation and a society in which each citizen had some share, some stake, some voice in a greater common endeavor. a more perfect union that established justice and promoted the general welfare, as they put it. Well, I have to throw in a very quick and necessary caveat here. The framers did clearly believe in protecting certain individual rights and liberties of each citizen. This is why they added the Bill of Rights to our Constitution, with Thomas Jefferson, from whom we've already heard, supplying some of that language. I do find the process here interesting, though, saying this as a great devotee of the Bill of Rights. It was after they had laid out a blueprint for a more perfect union that the founders then turned their attention to the individual rights, which they also believe rightly needed protecting. Okay, I'm going to speak to just two areas, only two, knowing there are many other possible ones, where the civil government has a role in helping us achieve a more perfect union. One is to provide and support channels through which citizens can come together and advocate for their common concerns and common interests. And the other is to manage to a certain degree, that is, the overall wealth of a society in a way that enhances the common good. That's generally called taxation. Since I'm throwing out caveats here, I'll throw in another one. I am not a political scientist or a political theoretician. I've never sought public office. I probably never will. Among the various things on my to-do list when I do retire, I don't have running for office in there among them. I'm just a guy who has been a minister for most of his adult life, and one who, without, I hope, being too stuffy about it, tends to look at the life of the society of which I'm a part through a moral lens. So that said, let me pick up on those two areas I mentioned. I would say labor unions are one of those channels through which citizens can come together to advocate for their shared interests and common concerns as workers, as employees in a particular field or trade or profession. As such, they have played a vital role in the advancement of social and economic justice in our nation over the past century and more. I am convinced that we are a more just, humane, and moral nation for their efforts. It was unions who brought us the 8-hour workday, who put laws in place that halted the exploitation of child labor, and who played an important role in bringing women into the workforce, just to cite three examples. The civil rights movement, furthermore, would not have had the energy that it did, would not have achieved some of the goals that it did, were it not for its partnership with certain segments of organized labor. And it was this kind of awareness, in fact, that brought Dr. King to Memphis. Like every other institution on the face of this earth, labor institutions are human institutions and are subject, therefore, at times to human shortcomings and human short-sightedness. I have no argument with the contention that labor union leaders, as well as their rank-and-file members, sometimes need to look beyond their own particular interests, compelling as they are, to a greater common good and make sacrifices that will enhance that common good. But we cannot even have a conversation about when to give and when to take, if unions, public or private, are going to be disempowered or disembodied. I agree as well that unions need to be a part of a wider deliberation about the overall general well-being of society, pointed and even contentious as such conversations can be at times. But here again, we can't even have those conversations, we can't even have that kind of give and take deliberation, if unions are going to be denied adequate access to the conversation itself. If certain corrective measures are warranted when it comes to the workings of certain aspects of organized labor, then fine, put it on the table and work it through. But do so while keeping in mind what former President Bill Clinton once said with respect to affirmative action: mend it, don't end it. On to my second point, about the right and proper management and use of wealth in a free and democratic society. One of the more fascinating tidbits I came across in gathering my material for these thoughts was about Andrew Carnegie. one of the financial giants of his or any other age in America. In 1889, when Mr. Carnegie was at the height of his financial success and prowess, he published an essay called The Gospel of Wealth. Interesting choice of words, gospel of wealth. And Carnegie's contention here was that the accumulation of wealth was so beneficial to society at large that government should take no action at all to impede that accumulation by those who were doing the accumulating. This is one of those things, though, where you don't want to stop reading at a particular point. You need to go on to see the rest of where he was going with all of that. Because Carnegie did not stop there. That was not even his main point. He felt, as he did, not because he thought the ongoing accumulation of wealth was a good thing in and of itself. In fact, he felt quite the opposite. He believed that wealthy people were really trustees of their wealth, and they should only hold on to it until a proper public use for it came along or was discovered. And Carnegie, furthermore, actually believed in his own gospel. He spent his last years, giving away much of his fortune, which included the building of some 2,800 public libraries all across our land. Indeed, one of the lines in his Gospel of Wealth essay held, "The man who dies rich dies disgraced." Wow. Think about that one. The man who dies rich dies disgraced. It has to be the complete antithesis of that line about whoever dies with the most toys wins. Well, the wealthier folks among us were all devout and practicing Carnegians. Maybe we wouldn't need to have debates and deliberations about what constitutes a fair and equitable tax rate for those whose earnings and personal worth are on the higher or highest end of the wealth scale in our country, or of those for mega corporations. But that's not the case. And that's why this kind of debate also needs to go forward. And just so I don't get too self-righteous here, now if I were to hit some super mega level lottery jackpot, I'm not sure how readily or willingly I'd line up behind Carnegie's dictum. Who knows? I might just say, okay, Andrew, so I die rich and in disgrace. I'm dead and I've had my fun. I'm far from sure my own sense of trusteeship would reach that of Mr. Carnegie's, which is why the tax people would probably have to come after me. To continue with this point, if we are at a point in our nation's history where trying economic conditions and realities called for shared sacrifice, and here again, I don't argue with that point. I just say, let's truly make it shared. If working people are going to be asked to pair their benefits, if certain of our social programs face the prospect of being less available to those who need them, then why shouldn't more, proportionally more, be asked of those whose security and livelihood and overall well-being would not be compromised one bit if they were mandated to pay a larger share? For a shared sacrifice isn't really a shared sacrifice unless it has an actual sacrificial effect upon all who are being asked to do the sharing. There is no such thing as a truly shared sacrifice unless all who make up our citizenry feel some effect from it. Otherwise, it's not shared. Close with this. In a few weeks, we will hold our annual congregational meeting here in this room. One of the things we'll do is vote on and presumably pass a budget for our upcoming church year. On paper, this budget is a pretty dry-looking document. Got a lot of numbers and labels and categories on it, and eyes kind of glaze over when you try to read it through. But dry as it might look, it's really a moral statement. It's a statement about how we in this congregation plan to fulfill, or at least make the best attempt we can at fulfilling, our church's mission and vision and covenant as put forth in our mission statement. Our budget is one, only one, but still one important one of the many expressions of who we are as a religious community and about what we aspire to be. Well, local, state, and national budgets, I know, are purely secular documents, and they are vastly more complicated, vastly more intricate than the one that we will be taking up here next month. But I think they are also, in the end, moral statements. Moral statements about how we as a society at its various levels intend to use our resources in living up to our values and principles. About how we intend to go about fulfilling that mission statement our founders put in place over two centuries ago. For all of our current economic challenges, and however sobering as they are, the realities of the state of our union may be, with respect to how our public monies are acquired and spent, we remain among the wealthiest nations on earth. I hope I am not too naive in believing that we can yet achieve a more perfect union that establishes justice, ensures domestic tranquility, and promotes the general welfare, as the drafters of our nation's mission statement put it. If I am naive in believing that such can yet be attained, then I guess our founders were naive too. But I hardly think they were. We pride ourselves on being a nation of self-directed individuals. Up to a point, I can affirm and celebrate that. Mainly because I, too, like to think of myself as a self-directed individual. But at the end of the day, I have to defer to the wisdom of Martin Luther King and return to him in closing by taking note of these words of his. An individual has not started living until he or she can rise above the confines of individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity. I hope the spirit of this outstanding American, whom we lost over 43 years ago, can help direct and inspire us now and in the days ahead. Let's think on this and sing together our closing hymn, "Its Wonders Still the World Shall Witness." It's number 139 of a misprint in order service, number 139. Let's sing that together.